Hi, Mage Fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast. Today's episode is three conversations I had with different community creators. The first is a conversation with Mike Diamond of the Old Ways Podcast, talking about their upcoming Mage the Ascension actual play, The Ascent of Babylon. Then at about 27:44, I talk with Chris Newton about the return of Mega Dumbcast and their loving walkthrough of early White Wolf supplements. And then at about the 40 minute and 50 second mark, I have a conversation with Tia Webb about their latest publication, Crushing Depths, a piece of Mage the Ascension fiction, available in the Storyteller Vault. For more information on any of these, please see our show notes. And then at the end of all that, I bring it home with credits. And with that, on with the show. Hi, Mage fans, this is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast. Joining me today is Michael Diamond, creative director of Old Ways Entertainment and the head of the Old Ways Podcast. The Old Ways Podcast is doing a Mage actual play, The Ascension of Babylon, and I am very excited for two parts of that. One, that it's Mage. The other, that Michael may be one of a small number of guests who has recorded seemingly 700 times as many episodes as I ever have. So if you are a patron, you will hear our pre-conversation where I just go, Michael, you talk good. Can you tell me to talk good too? And Michael goes, maybe. So that'll be available on our Patreon feed either now, sooner or later. Michael, how you doing?
Good, Terry. How are you? Nice to be with you.
I am presentable. What is Old Ways Entertainment and kind of where did it come from?
Okay. Yeah. So Old Ways Entertainment is the more legal version of our show name, which is the Old Ways Podcast, which came about in 2019, sitting around the dining room table with my friends when we were beginning our grand Call of Cthulhu campaign. And I put a Tascam, omnidirectional microphone, of course, for those of you educated, in the center of the table and said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we recorded this? And then my, what I like to call techno lust, sort of took over, and I began adding more and more gear. We continued to record and push out episodes. Just one every 2 weeks was back in the day what we did. Oh, if they could see us then.
Time was simpler then. Pepperidge Farm remembers. And as you mentioned, it was simpler then. Kind of what was then the trajectory that brought you to the podcast production dynamo that you are now?
Yeah, so I think what I got was feedback. And I changed based off of feedback. And people were like, hey, this story is really cool, but I would really like to be able to hear you better. And so we got a traditional mixer board up there. And I went from one to two to eventually four, and then finally six microphones at the dining room table. And then essentially most of the people in the house said, listen, this is getting a little out of control, don't you think? And I said, it is, but I'm enjoying myself. Well, we eventually renovated the basement here in the house, and that's where we placed the studio now, to sound nice and fancy for everybody.
Why do you think there's so comparatively few in-person World of Darkness actual plays? It seems to be that a lot of the really successful D&D and other style ones involve a bunch of people in a room, but we still seem to be primarily in the Zoom era for OWOD.
I think when it comes to World of Darkness games, I think finding good World of Darkness players can be a little tricky. And I also think that some of the more veteran players, I think that's a nice term to put, likely are probably doing other things or just not as interested. I'm fortunate in the regard that my local players are.
Nice. The name of this project is The Ascension of Babylon. What is that? Where does it take place? And kind of what should a listener expect?
That's a great question. So The Ascension of Babylon is a Mage 20th Anniversary Edition game that is being set in primarily Las Vegas, Nevada. And what is it about? Well, it's really about four distinctly different people awakening and learning what their paths are in the modern day. And so it's a unique game, I believe, a unique style of telling this story, which I'll be happy to sort of get into in a second. It's a way for the listener to experience Mage from the eyes of someone who's just awakening to it. And so what we're trying to do there is capture a new listening audience that perhaps has not experienced Mage before and give them the feeling of awakening to a new world.
Why do you think Las Vegas has proven to be such a popular setting specifically for Mage the Ascension? It's the only city book we have. I've talked to a number of players, and independently of that, they've chosen it as their setting. It's a location where a number of Storyteller Vault settings include. What do you think makes Vegas so magey, or what drew you to it?
It's dirty in so many different ways. So it's a place where money and power and political acumen and technology all converge to do sort of the same thing in different ways, which is to fund the money machine in a lot of different ways. I was drawn to it because there's sizzle to a place like Las Vegas.
If you didn't set it in Las Vegas, what other places do you think have a similar feel, or do you think Las Vegas is unique?
Well, both a little bit. Like, I think Vegas is unique, but I think this tale could be told perhaps in a slightly different way, but maybe in Hong Kong, it could be played there. I think it could be played in London potentially, although it would several factors it would sort of have to be altered. Having been to one of those cities, I don't know that London is on the same pulse level as Las Vegas is. So yeah, there's some differences.
Who are the characters that we're going to meet, or kind of what is their nature? Is this a game that leans heavily into the traditions or the conventions? Are characters finding their own way? Are they going to get courted? What should we expect to see from these new magi?
Yeah, so the great part about this and sort of the uniqueness of the story is that the characters are going to have multiple voices to listen to. So they're going to awaken each one. The way we normally do it in the old ways is when we go through a new campaign is you get a prelude episode, a single episode from each character first before the first full cast episode. And it lets you learn about what makes the initial character tick. And in ours for Mage, all of them are going to be awakening episodes. And so each one will have a unique awakening that they go through and then a unique voice. And so unlike some of the other Mage APs that I've seen, what the old ways is doing is it's having a separate player play their avatar. So that way there's a completely different voice and viewpoint from the player than the storyteller.
Now, is that something that persists through the series, kind of like your shadow in Wraith?
Yeah, it will. It will persist through the series. Now, the avatar's voices won't be present in every episode, but they are present in some of the episodes that we've recorded to date.
Okay. Rules-wise, for actual plays, there's kind of a spectrum. One of the popular ones is to try and make a V5 hack for Mage. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have something where rules are essentially invisible. Red Moon role-playing comes to mind. For someone who is new to Mage, where are you systematically? How close to you or to rules is written? And how much do the rules or any rulings or roles stay in the show?
Okay, so a couple of things. Sort of off the bat, I would say that the game is being run with the 20th anniversary rules in the sense of adjudication of dice rolls, I would say 95% of the time. What you're going to get from me as a storyteller is sometime a little bit of softening on certain things where I will allow open adjudication of how something should be rolled, because I think that players and the audience are appreciative of that kind of flexibility when it comes to it. And as far as any sort of reflection towards V5 or potential M5, I'm good. I don't need anything else other than the 20th anniversary for me.
And I guess, why are you doing this now? As we mentioned, V5 is out. Mage 20th has been out for seemingly 8 years. Why did Mage come up in queue kind of now?
That's a good question. So for us, when we started in 2019, we were very much a Call of Cthulhu-centered podcast. So we played a lot of Call of Cthulhu, including Masks of Neelhaftep, and then eventually Horror on the Orient Express, two really grand campaigns. And all that grandness takes an awful lot of time away from me and what I can actually prepare for. And I have had just a ton of Mage books on my shelf for years, and I kept thinking, we'll get to it, we'll get to it. And then we got to sort of the last season starting for Masks, and I began to think, okay, well, Masks is going to wrap up in X number of months. What do you want to prepare for next, right? And during that time, we had a V5 show that aired for us called Blood Moon Rising. It had two seasons, eventually had Shards of San Francisco, but it was a World of Darkness setting. We played a little bit of Victorian Age Mage, a two-part episode we got to play when the Victorian Age Mage rules came out. And I said, yeah, like there's an appetite for it. So a lot of the stuff we do on the Always podcast is precipitated by what our backers and our feedback that we get. That's why we do it. So if you see something come up on the show, it's likely because enough people tugged on my jacket and were like, hey, we'd really like you to see you play X. Or say a company like Onyx Path, who has before, came in and said, we'd like you to play this because it's in support of crowdfunding and that sort of thing.
Do you feel that when fans requested Mage, that was because they wanted to see how it works? Or I guess you could say, actual plays from a fan perspective could come into kind of three different things. One, I loved playing this and I want to see someone else love playing it. Two, I haven't gotten a chance to play this and I want to see it played. And I guess third would be, oh man, this troupe is really good or has an interesting take on things. I want to see their version of Mage. Do you think for Mage the Ascension that blend differed from maybe Call of Cthulhu?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say that for us, for Mage, I think probably points one and three are the most, where we have older listeners who played a lot of World of Darkness who are like, not a lot of people play Mage. We'd love to see you play Mage, just because they know the players that we get. Our players tend to dig in really deep narratively. So they're going to get into their characters, they're going to produce backgrounds, and they're going to want to show how that character can change over time, right? Either positively or negatively, they want to be able to show that arc. And so we get people interested, hey, play Mage because we'd love to see you play it. And so we're making sure to honor that request.
Yeah, I feel like with Mage, there's a lot of people aspirationally watching actual plays. Like when someone watches a D&D actual play, they can go, oh, that looks like my group, or I've wanted to play, I just didn't have the time. Where for Mage, there's this kind of arousal that occurs where you're like, oh, I've never touched the dark diamond that is the that is the purple tome. Right. One of the questions I have is, how did you get the cast on board? To which your response was simply, I told them I'd be running Mage. They were very eager to play. And
yeah, I had one player who shot up out of their seat. So I said, you know, listen, folks, this show is gonna end. We're gonna wrap, and here are my ideas. I want to do X, and then I want to play Mage. And I got the word Mage out of my mouth, and they were like, hell yes, I'm playing that. I'm here for that right now. And that's part and parcel because they too also grew up with the World of Darkness, and there aren't a lot of Mage games, and it's a very different game than a lot of the games we get to play because it can potentially just be so wide open. And that's intriguing to a lot of people.
So one of the things we haven't really gotten is kind of what that play experience is going to look like. Obviously, you can't tell us the choices your players are going to make or necessarily reveal your antagonists or anything like that. But kind of what were your inspirational media, and what does the World of Darkness, specifically Mage, look like to you? What is the sensory experience of it? How common is magic? What does it feel like being out in the world? Are there supernatural elements around every corner? Are they much rarer? Kind of what are you looking towards for inspiration? And how does that translate into your World of Darkness?
So I think about a lot of things when it comes to what inspires me for Mage. A lot of stuff in movies, a lot of stuff in books, and a lot of stuff on television as far as disparate media is concerned, but also like occult tomes, right? Because I'm the guy who has, you know, umpteen bookshelves and stuff like that. And so, of course, there's all sorts of different texts that I have read to inspire me. But I think there are a certain number of groundbreaking shows, I would say. So let's take a show like a recent era, right? So let's take Westworld. I could see Westworld very easily as a separate horizon realm, or even a really powerful bubble of reality where someone has fashioned a universe for themselves. And people go into and out of it until eventually like the egg breaks, et cetera. And then we have, you know, overrunning robots, et cetera, whatever, you know, as you do. And then I also think of, you can even take touchstones from, say, like a superhero-esque show, which is basically low-level marauders running around and just bleeding reality dry and melting streets and that sort of thing. That is interesting. But for me, when it comes to Mage, it's very much, I still get the street level feel from a standard World of Darkness game, in the sense that stuff breaks, people die, the shadows are a little darker, the lights are brighter to sort of offset that too, except that they're at a distance. And what people are going to get when they get into the Ascension of Babylon is they're going to meet four relatively normal people that have average careers and average everyday lives. And just little tiny things in their reality begin to fracture along the way. My Mage is a little subtle. I don't think there are going to be any sort of immediate contrast with like high fantasy or anything like that. Magic isn't around every corner. Werewolves aren't sitting in your laundry room. At least you hope not. But I think that's sort of the feel for it.
Do you feel in your game that mages are monsters?
I think they can be. I think monster is a mentality, not a phenotype. So I think you could take a tradition mage, let's just say a very popular one, and perhaps someone who spent a whole lot of time at Doicetep, and you could say that they're a monster for some of the choices that they made. The same thing could be true of an NWO agent. The same thing could potentially be true of your standard Son of Ether, right? With all of their concoctions and potentially their laboratories. But monster by their very nature? No. I think that mages are people on a journey. And sometimes those journeys go very dark places. And sometimes they don't. Sometimes people just get a chance to lead good lives, although I doubt that will happen in our story.
Do you feel that is fundamentally different from the other lines in the World of Darkness? Do you feel that either that blend differs for the other lines, or the nature of the question is somehow ill-formed? For instance, are all vampires monsters to you?
Oh, that's a good question. So I guess when we talk about vampire, we talk about the push-pull relationship you have with your humanity. And in what way that translates to your gameplay and how your character looks on life in general. The same thing technically could be true if you look at werewolf from a specific point of view, where how much are you giving over to, you know, Weaver Wild Worm, and in what state are you, how are you reacting to the political and the human climate and the associated tragedies therein? I think mage is a little different in that fundamentally they are given a spark that really no one else has. And that uniqueness allows them to transcend some of the potential pitfalls, but then at the same time, and sort of beautifully, it opens up massive gulfs that they can fall into, and with cataclysmic repercussions. And I think that's really the draw of the game, right? Phenomenal cosmic power, tiny little human body, to paraphrase Robin Williams. But I think that that's where the core of it is. I don't see them as monsters. I see them as uniquely set against the other people in the World of Darkness.
Are there any supernatural or magical elements about Las Vegas or your campaign that you can share?
Yeah, the ascension of Babylon is going to happen whether you like it or not. I'm just going to leave that there.
Okay. This is something that you've already been recording for a bit. Is there anything that surprised you in terms of what happened along those first few episodes that you think a listener might find particularly intriguing or kind of really demonstrates mage to you?
Yeah. So I'll give you this little preview. We have in the game the awakenings, but the day after really is very important. Because all of our players go through the idea that they're now paired or they're awake, that their avatar is readily available to them, but they don't necessarily know how to use it. So the four players are veteran World of Darkness players, but not all of them have played Mage of the Ascension before. So they don't know where any of these sort of automatic levers are that you and I would just know, okay, I can probably trend my character in this way, and this is how I'll develop this. We are developing their paradigms, their foci, all that stuff is happening in game. None of it's getting washed over. And they're getting some of those initial sensory experiences, whether it comes to forces or prime or the ability to know, oh yeah, it's 2:45 and 43 seconds and 44 and 45. We're doing all that stuff in game to give the listener the idea that they get to wake up along with the characters and understand it from the ground up.
So it sounds like this is a good opportunity for someone who hasn't maybe got a chance to play a lot of Mage or even to run a lot of Mage to get an idea of what a Mage game can be. Not necessarily what it has to be, but it seems to be a kind of maximal interpretation of the steps on the path of thorns, as it were, where it goes from this is the life before, this is the first conversation with the avatar, this is the awkward figuring it out period that is normally glossed over in like a montage.
Yeah. So I will give this little tiny little tidbit to two of the characters meet. We'll just say an orphan. And one of the first tidbits they get about any of the tradition is handed to them sort of through the jaundiced view of a Las Vegas orphan. And I think that lesson I'm trying to teach here is that not only you, the listener, but also the player are going to learn things based off of other people's perspectives. And going on those perspectives might be dangerous because you need to find your own truth, what makes truth yours, rather than somebody else's experiences.
And finally, what is secretly my question? Technically, what does the workflow look like? And there are two sides to this. One is the technical work as a GM, figuring out setting, put down plot, and then technical in terms of kind of your editing workflow as you go from pre-recording to getting an episode out in the world that your listeners get to enjoy. So what does your GM workflow look like, your storyteller workflow?
So I keep an overall outline document of the first season. I usually write seasons at a time. And this is a fairly, I would say, light outline. And that is, this is going to happen at this time. This is going to happen at this time. And then I have movable and unmovable things. So these are guideposts that says, it doesn't matter what happens in the storyline, the greater story, this guidepost happens at this juncture. And while I might have to be a little flexible when it comes to mage or some of that, because they could potentially sort of uproot that post, for the most part, I keep them as standard guidelines. Throughout each session, though, when I break a session down, I break it down into story beats. And so filmmaking technique that I use where you have X number of cards. So as an example, a TV episode might have 20 3x5 flashcards, and it goes through every scene to get to 20. I have 20 cards to tell my story. If I go over, I have to move those cards around, or I have to remove cards to make the narrative tighter, right? Movies do the same thing, except they usually do it with 40 cards for a 2-hour movie. A 1.5-hour session means I get about 10 cards. What I do is constrain myself to about 4 beats or 4 cards to give the players a maximum amount of breathing room for their own decisions. Because I'd never want my belief about what a story should be to trample the story that the characters are telling themselves. That's super important to me, because I feel like in the AP world, it is very easy to, quote, be perceived of it as a scripted show. And we're not scripted, and we'll never be scripted. But that doesn't mean that the workflow side of me doesn't have to have a job to do. It does. So we record 2 episodes at a time. We record them in roughly 4-hour blocks. And then after that, I take them into Reaper, which is the DAW that I use. I line up all my tracks and I chop. I do all of my cut edits. I correct for sound. And then I drop in any sound effects, any voice modulations, any music, because we're a full experience. So you're going to get background music and sound effects, and hopefully cast members that sound really good. That's sort of the aim with the equipment purchases that we've had. And then cut to air is usually 3 to 4 weeks. And so, like, as we speak right now, the patron backers, so if you back us at the Old Ways podcast, you're going to get an opportunity to get a hold of all of the Mage Preludes early, before they air. So you'll have 2 or 3 preludes to enjoy before the public has had a chance to view any of them. That'll give you sort of a leg up when the real episodes start to drop. And yeah, that's generally about a 2 to 4 week, depending upon it. As a backlog, it depends. I'm careful with the backlog, especially, Terry, because one of the key things is that we have a backer level where you can actually affect what happens in the story. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be able to potentially give mages quintessence. You might be able to add dice to a paradox backlash if you don't like a particular character. We're huge into the idea of community involvement in our stories through a device we call the Hand of Fate. And so they'll be given some options. Backers also can create NPCs for us to use. They also have the ability to create locations, which is a huge benefit. And then we run them live on the story.
Interesting. One, those are some fascinating backer benefits. I'm kind of curious to see how that turns out, but you've made mention of the Patreon and the Old Ways podcast. So where can we get all this stuff?
Absolutely. So you can check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/theoldwayspodcast. We just went over 1,000 YouTube subscribers. So if you type in the Old Ways podcast to YouTube, you can find us there. And then while there is video of us, so we did go to some conventions last year. We have some Q&A, none of them with necessarily the mage group. That hasn't been done yet, but there will probably be sort of a patrons season ending video that we'll put up where we have a collaborative chat with not only all of the mages, but also their avatars as well.
And if we want to subscribe to this, is there a webpage that we should go to?
Yeah, we're on Apple Podcasts. You can find us over there. You can find us on Spotify, Overcast, any major podcast app you'll be able to find us on. And then definitely the Patreon is the biggest thing. And of course, everybody talks about that because support is critical for stuff like this. If you enjoy the World of Darkness, if you enjoy Mage and you want to see more of it, supporting the show is the best way. $3 a month buys you clear feed when it comes to ads. So there are never any ad rolls on the Patreon. It's ad-free. I can't say that, obviously, for Spotify and or Apple Podcasts. They do their own thing, which certainly, of course, helps the show. But your direct support also helps us give back. So we're a patron account that also gives quarterly to a lot of different charities, and we get involved socially. And so if that's something that you're interested in, check us out.
Awesome. Michael, I'm very excited to hear the product that actually comes out the other end. I just subscribe to the Patreon without listening because that's how I roll. So I look forward to being hailed as the savior of Babylon eventually, obviously in the fullness of time. But any other considerations or any other projects that you would like listeners to be aware of, like if they like the Mage stuff, is there another place, is there a next step that you feel they should go?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of things. Our community, we have our own Patreon community. Obviously, we also have our own Discord community where we talk all about all the different games that we play. You can check us out on Discord. We'll have those links there. But as far as shows go, we've got a lot of different material. Now that the major Call of Cthulhu stuff is winding down, we're playing a lot of different games. We have a Trinity series that's out that we play both Adventure, we play Aeon, we play basically every flavor of Trinity in a sort of a short show so you could get to those. And then in the near future, I'll just say you might be seeing us more often.
Dun, dun, dun. And you did Horror on the Orient Express in 5 seasons, making it, I think, the fastest playthrough of Horror on the Orient Express that has ever been documented. So congratulations on that.
Oh, yeah. If you like horror and sort of strange investigations, but in a more modern era, you should totally check out our Delta Green series. So we're currently playing through Impossible Landscapes. I'll just say, not to pat myself on the back, but John Scott Tynes, one of the creators of Delta Green's amazing universe, commented on one of our show drops and said, would you please make more and release them faster? And so I will absolutely take that as a compliment.
Yeah, that was like when I met Jason Carl and he's like, Mage the Podcast is the best. I can't remember the string of qualifiers. I may have blacked out by the end of it, but he's like, it's the best Old World of Darkness informational podcast that is still regularly producing episodes. And that may have narrowed the universe down to just me, but at that point, but I just felt like the prettiest girl at the ball. but yeah, that's always good to hear. And Impossible Landscapes, Mage 20th Horror, you keep picking these small books to run from.
Well, I mean, as you can see, of course the listeners can't, but there's an awful large shelf of purple books back there. We have a lot of work to do, and we'll get there.
Michael, thank you so much for doing this, and thank you for taking the time to explain it. Once more, if you just want to tell where direct listeners to, that would be great. Otherwise, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you just search the Old Ways Podcast on any of your standard podcast apps, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and I'll say YouTube, clearly. So the big thing about YouTube, not only subscribing there, but we also have everything in a playlist. And so if you just want to listen to a single show and you don't want the rest of our shows, you can just go to our playlist. That's pretty easy. And then, yeah, I'm on Blue Sky. We're on Facebook and some of the other social media sites, especially those that aren't burning down around us.
That's a polite way to put it. Links to all of those will be in our show notes. Michael, thank you so much for your work and thank you so much for joining.
Yep. Thanks, Terry.
Hi, Mage fans, this is your host, Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast, and today we are talking about the triumphant return of something true and wonderful. Is it that we've regained connection to Horizon? No. Is it that DeWizitep is once again accepting students? No. Is it that Senex has broken the wards around the Shard Realm of Entropy, declaring the death of Vormos and the return of order to the cosmos? No. Is it the fact that secret agent John Courage has finally failed a single Esperanto class? No. We are talking about something even greater than that. Long ago, in the dim ages, in the dark times of podcasting, before the Rona, before the coming of the Tumph, there was the Mega Dumbcast. This was a work of podcasting artistry, of singular vision, where a producer, nay prophet, chose to go page by page through some of the dumbest but loved publications in the history of role-playing, and to explain to you, the audience, why they were dumb. Frequently, this would involve lengthy verbal descriptions of pictures. Sometimes this would involve discussing weird grammatical hang-ups, and in yet other cases, templating. The person who made that possible, Chris, is joining me today virtually, and I would like to wish a warm Mage the Podcast welcome to Chris of the Mega Dumbcast. Chris, how you doing?
I mean, look, better than in years after that intro. I feel re-energized.
A little bit of a hype man, a little bit of a glow up.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. I do appreciate, and I know you didn't mean it this way, but I do appreciate the subtle burn of singular vision. This is my new go-to for, like, what do you think of my new idea? Boy, you have a singular vision.
It's like describing a flavor as unique or indescribable. You're like, yes, this is sui generis among the concept of food. So, Chris, what is the Mega Dumbcast, and kind of where did that idea come from?
thank you for the definite article. I appreciate it when people refer to my podcast the way they would refer to Batman, the Batman. It's Mega Dumbcast, a daily podcast. The idea came from originally my love of Palladium games rather than White Wolf games, which are, Palladium games are like, and I know this is going to be hard to believe for White Wolf fans, but like much shaggier, like much more poorly edited, like the rules don't work well as compared to early White Wolf games. And so those books are like books I grew up with, and Ninjas and Super Spies was the first one I did. And I sort of realized as I was thinking of kind of podcast concepts, there could be something to talk about on every page of this book. There's something wrong with every single page. That fit with the idea of like doing a short podcast, which is something I wanted to experiment with because my other podcast at the time, Gameable, was unconscionably long. And so I thought like, yeah, let me do like 5-minute episodes, 10-minute episodes every day, one about each page. And so I did Ninjas and Super Spies. I did Heroes Unlimited. I did Beyond the Supernatural, all Palladium games. I also got into White Wolf with Secrets of Shadaloo, which is a supplement for White Wolf's Street Fighter role-playing game. And then I did some of the old Marvel Superheroes games. I did supplements for those. That was the first time I did like adventures on the podcast. And then I moved on. There was this break that I took. The current season at last is about World of Darkness material, which is the other like big, other than Palladium, I'd say like the big role-playing game I grew up with was Vampyre in particular and World of Darkness in general. So yeah, it's really fun to get into these books and look at the dumbest thing on every single page. It's very different from Palladium, but no more challenging.
Yeah, it's a different kind of dumb. It's good to know that mm-hmm. there are like regional cultivars of stupid running around yes. out there. And the glorious thing about the process is that it is obvious that it is dripping with love. The Mega Dumbcast, hosted by the Chris, talks about the books and the RPG that you the love the most. I figure yes. if I'm going to overuse the definite article, I should just super lean into it.
I was not trying to nag you about that. I do sure. like it.
Oh, sure. You could just wear anything. What is Alien Hunger and kind of why start there?
So Alien Hunger is, I believe, the first published adventure for Vampire the Masquerade as an independent product. Like there was an adventure in a core book. But and so I think as I was looking for White Wolf material to cover, World of Darkness material, I definitely wanted to do Vampyre because that's what I'm most familiar with and like what I have a history with. And I think that the Mage has its own flavor, but like the level of pretentiousness in Vampyre stuff and especially early Vampyre stuff really like gives me something to talk about on pages where there otherwise wouldn't be anything. Just the, you know, I can always return to smugness if I can't find anything else. Alien Hunger, like I wanted to start early in the line's run. So that's pretty much as early as you can get. And also, and I do not want to spoil this for listeners, Alien Hunger is notable for having at least one big dumb reveal you would not expect. And because when I do adventures, I don't spoil things ahead of time. So I sort of like reveal the situation, the plot and everything as we go through the story. It appealed to me to have a big dumb reveal in the season. And I'm moving forward to do other World of Darkness material using the same cast of characters that come from Alien Hunger. So the fact that Alien Hunger has pre-gens and also allows you to create an original character as a player character as well, that was like, okay, I can start early and then I can take these characters forward through other World of Darkness adventures and sort of like level them up, translate them to new editions, and we can sort of follow the story. And sort of with the concept, if it was 1991 and you were just getting into this new game called Vampyre and you created some player characters and played the only adventure they had available and then just kept playing Vampyre until Gehenna, what could that have been like? How would it have been done
that
in different
Vampyre
years?
Vampyre would have a hell of a flat top. Source material for the gothic punk city of Denver. That's an amazing line. I'm always worried about talking about some of these texts because like I think about like how old Andrew Greenberg and Sam Chupp were at the time, and they were all in their early 20s. So yeah. I'm always worried about this, partially punching down on them. But at the same time, you read some of the stuff and you're like, man, we could have saved ourselves a lot of hurt if someone had just given these people a wedgie.
I will say that is something, it's actually come up in a recent episode that I just edited, where I was in the uncomfortable position, as I sometimes am, of commenting on the work of someone who has passed away. And so there's this kind of like, especially someone who like it's an early death and someone like there's a tragedy there. And for the same reason that like, it's important to be sensitive about that, I in a weird way, for the same reason it's important to be sensitive about like Kevin Sambita, who is deserving of a lot of things, good and bad. But I always want to give credit to like, here's a creator who made an impact on me. And how many goddamn creators can say that. That like they made a permanent impact on someone's life, lots of people's lives. Like it was a formative experience. Their art formatively affected people. And so it's never like, just as oftentimes the dumb thing on a page is a thing I love. Like I love that there's a dumb thing in this book. Similarly, the creators often are like, I wouldn't remember this book if it were written by people in their 30s who knew what the fuck they were doing.
That's a good point. Alien Hunger, it's only 68 pages. Mm-hmm. Where do you have anything you can reveal on where you plan on going from there for people who are like, eh, that one,
I'm sorry, I'm trying to recalibrate for this hypothetical audience.
Sure.
If that's the sound you just made, dear listener, then can I interest you, instead of in this sort of like wishy-washy, like we're hanging out in Denver, Colorado, like it's kind of goth, it's kind of punk, but like basically the prince just wants to like wear jeans and play guitar and like everybody's pretty much chill. I'm now moving on to Awakening Diablery : Mexico, which is essentially an extremely hardcore dungeon crawl for vampire. There are not going to be any blue jeans, except for the blue jeans you bring with you as you descend into the heart of the ancient Mayan or possibly Aztec Empire and confront an elder who, I can't say anymore. It's all spoilers. It is, as I describe in the first episode of the new leg of the season, this is going to be a 10-week date with an elder vampire whose extremely misleading profile picture is on the cover of this book.
Understood. Going to be a BYOBJ adventure. Mm-hmm. Bring your own blue jeans. And I'm excited to go through it again.
When you send out that invitation, you really need to clarify.
Yes. Yes. There's a certain ambiguity there that can really slay the mood of a party. Now, In addition to that, correct me if I'm wrong, but people who do choose to support you on Patreon will get access to some exclusive content that has been done with a cavalcade of delightful co-hosts of yours that have various views on fornication with creatures of the night. Is that bonus material still available? And what is that? And we're going to replace the F word and either say the F word or F.
Okay. All right.
If that's okay.
That is absolutely fine. I assumed you're going to have to bleep this episode anyway. I assume that future editor Terry has like got the finger on the button, but that's fine. So there's a side series called F, Mary, Slay, which is where I went through with Claire Mulcairn and we talked about all of the different vampire clans from Vampire. And then I had some like rotating hosts for various vampire bloodlines as well. And in each of them, we talked about the potential F ability, Mary ability, which is to say like, would you want to be embraced into this clan or bloodline, and Slay ability, like how evil are they? How much is it imperative that you kill them for each of these clans, for each of these bloodlines? That series, it's over now, but it was a really good time. And we did all 13 clans and a bunch of bloodlines. There's all kinds of great stuff in there with like, we created dream dates for each of the clans. And so we like created a character who had like sort of the sex appeal we found in the clan. And yeah, I've recorded with a bunch of people.
I dare say these were not dilettantes or amateurs in the world of assessing the effability of various monsters and creatures of the night.
Definitely not.
Yes. You and Claire brought a certain literary capability to it, whereas there were additional guests who were like, no, you are in my house and let me show you how I play. And I was not initially prepared for it, but after I put on my monster effer pants, it was good, clean fun, given that you were fundamentally talking about monster effing.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah.
I'm very proud. I did an episode about the Gargoyles bloodline where we had a little game we played during that episode that we had to break out into a whole separate bonus episode because it went like a half hour. I don't think I can say the name of the game on the podcast maybe, but if you join the Patreon and look up F, Mary, Slay, Gargoyles, then you will get, at the beginning of that episode, there's a description of the side episode you can find. We're deep in the weeds now. Yes. Essentially, at this point, I just have to sort of use innuendo to describe to you what you'll find on the Patreon.
Yeah, the idea of the notion of what you may receive for your mere $1 a month.
Yes, and that is the important thing to know, is that truly I want people to know that they are participating in a scam on Patreon. This is not really to raise money. It is really to get money instead of paying money for a separate RSS feed because Mega Dumbcast is a daily show, but lots of people like to listen to it in megasodes, the chunks, like every Sunday, instead of a regular episode, I put out a megasode, which compiles the week's previous episodes. It was a real pain in everyone's ass to have those on the same feed so that if you listen to the show, you end up with every episode twice. So instead of paying for more podcast hosting, I got a Patreon. So if you sign up for $1 a month, then you get access to this whole other feed and you get the megasodes. So it's about how you like to listen to the show, as well as the bonus content on Patreon.
Yeah, it's like a video game where you paid and not have to do the grind. I appreciate that. So yeah, It is something that I have listened to for years quite enjoyably. I knew none of the Palladium games, and by the end of it, I felt like I had a certain intimacy with those titles in the same way that you would have intimacy with a neighbor who had strange hobbies and predilections and never put their blinds down. That is kind of the relationship I developed with some of those properties. Anything else you have going on in the podcastiverse or artistically or any other products or ideas that you want to shout out now?
Oh, I do want to mention specifically for listeners to this podcast, I'm following Vampire Characters through Vampire Supplements this season. It's going to be going pretty much all year long with a couple of little breaks. The next thing I'm covering after Awakening Diablerie : Mexico is actually a short mage adventure. And yeah, it's designed for mage or vampire players, in theory. I'm looking really forward to getting into some mage content on the podcast. I don't know very much about it, but my disdain for the early material, I feel like, is very strong with mage as it is with vampire, and that's the important thing. If you love mage and want to hear it kicked around a little bit, I think you will appreciate the next leg of this season.
And we very much look forward to reaching that point. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks so much for this delightful and uplifting adventure into the world of RPGs in a world of utter grognardery.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast. And joining me today is noted Mage the Ascension fiction author, T.L. Webb. TL's done a number of installments, is probably one of the most popular producers of storyteller content in the world of fiction. And TL is here to talk about his latest edition, Crushing Depths. TL, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good today. I just survived a 47th birthday and seemed to be all intact. A little creakier.
Nice. Yeah, it's a very slow entropy effect that gets cast over the decades. It's very hard to reverse, but with proper diet and exercise and taking care of ourselves, we can have a small life one effect to slowly delay some of that, but not all of it. So
I seem to do something about my knees clicking when I get up. I'm failing my stealth check all over the place.
I remember the first time I picked up a heavy object in front of my stepkid, and I grunted. And I'm like, and they're like, you grunted? I'm like, yeah, I grunted. Did you plan on grunting? No, I didn't plan on grunting. Have I done that before? No. So apparently upon becoming a stepfather, I just reflexively started doing it. And if there's no one around, like, don't do it. I only seemingly do it in front of people under the age of 20. I need to investigate that. Maybe some sort of guiche was placed on me, similarly to your knees.
Reflexing on the young.
Yes. Yeah. So what is Crushing Depths?
Crushing Depths is a two-fisted action-adventure story set in the Hollow Earth, or traveling to the Hollow Earth. Most of it's in the Hollow Earth.
Does this build off of previous work that you've done directly? Will you have to have read the immediate book before this, or can a new listener, just a reader, just kind of jump in?
And this one, you can just jump in, although it does build on things that happened before. If you've read Cyberpunk, or if you've read Gathering Shadows, you're going to see characters and be, oh, that's why they're doing that. But mostly, the characters show up, are weird, and then either depart or hang out, depending on the story needs.
So you mentioned this is a expedition to get to the Hollow Earth. Who is involved in it, and kind of what are some one or two interesting things that might be happening along the way?
Well, to set things up, a character from Cyberpunk shows up at Aetherite Dwight Cogmeister's house. And Albert Edison has not been having a good time since Cyberpunk. He picked up a bit of a paradox flaw. He was showing off a little bit, and he zigged when he should have zagged. And now he's got electricity sparking off of him and uncontrollably and randomly. And this is not a good situation if you have to go in a submersible vessel to travel through an underwater network of underwater caves to get to the Hollow Earth. So he's passing on the buck to his fellow survivor of the Opacus Cactus Rally in Fireball Run. And Dwight Cogmeister is taking up the torch, and he's going to head down there and talk to one of the Aetherite professors who trained the man who attacked them in the first story.
Got it. And does the story ultimately result in getting to Hollow Earth? Do we get to talk about punching Nazis, riding dinosaurs, dealing with Eldritch Horrors, and so on? Or
all of that does happen through the course of it. First, Dwight's got to get down there. He's got to negotiate with a relative of his to get the submersible to get down there. He's got an ally, Virginia V. Evergreen, and she's a roboticist Aetherite. She came up to Dallas from New Orleans during the Hurricane Katrina migration.
Okay.
They're her family just hung around, and they know each other pretty good, and they're going to go down there together and see what's what.
This is kind of interesting. You mentioned submersible. When I think Hollow Earth, I generally think caves and such. Is this a digger? Is this oceanic? The title Crushing Depths implies water might be involved. What is your kind of vision for getting to the Hollow Earth?
Well, in this case, the passage to the Hollow Earth, I don't know if you know anything about the ground in Texas, but the ground in Texas is weird. Our water table is really high. There's a lot of underground water. There are no natural lakes in Texas. So Aetherites have found an aquifer. They've anchored it to Hollow Earth, and this one very, very determined, he built himself a little paradise down there. He's gone down and he has built a place called Valentine Station, and it's built in a gravity anomaly. So it's kind of upside down on the ceiling next to an oceanic area of the Hollow Earth. But to get there, you go through a long series of underwater tunnels. It takes about 12 hours. There's a rest stop on the way.
Oh, that's good.
You got to have tea if you're an Aetherite.
Popeyes like, or something there, yeah. And yeah, the hydrology of Texas is kind of fascinating. You kind of have like 1.5 major lakes, and one is shared with Louisiana, and it's more of an extended swamp, but there are very few sizable bodies of open water that would go much beyond pond. Yeah, that's had more than one Texan mention that, and the first time I'm like, that doesn't sound right, and then it's like, no, that's... I checked. It's pretty low on the list. And you mentioned this is two-fisted action. What would you say the theme and mood of it are?
The mood is a travel investigation. You're going on a journey. They make their way down there. There's some drama at the rest stop, and they pick up a couple of stragglers, which are hollow ones from Gathering Shadows, in fact. And they together make it their way to Valentine Station. They are welcomed. Well, the hollow ones are not welcome. They're interviewed because people want to know about Ambassador Case. The station is attacked in the middle of the Valentine Gala, little party they put on every year to celebrate the founding. And the attack is unexpected. It doesn't seem to have any direct tie to the story. But through the course of these stories, there is what we like to call a big, bad, evil guy, BBEG. And he is starting to get frustrated that people are poking at what he's doing. And one of his counterattacks is to sick some Hollow Earth Nazis on this place.
You've introduced a slowly expanding cast of characters. What does this one focus on, and is there anyone new that you want to talk about?
There is V. She's brand new. Dwight, of course, showed up in Fireball Run, had a small scene in the second story of Dead Reckoning, and he's taking center stage here. My original plan was to have each of the first of the three stories after Fireball 1 featuring one of the surviving characters on their stage of the investigation. And then things got weird when I came up with Gathering Shadows. Now, Gathering Shadows, is the fourth story. Fourth always goes well. Nothing bad happens on the fourth time. It's not unlucky in any cultures around the world. But I decided to take that little diversion with the Hollow Ones. But through the course of that story, a couple of them split off from the rest of the group. And here they are showing up at the waypoint to Valentine's Station. One of them's name is, she goes by Dormouse. She wanted people to remember what she said. And she's a Korean woman. She is basically saw Laura Croft and made it her whole personality. She practices a type of magic rooted in weaving. She is nightmarish when she has hold of any kind of fabrics. She can unravel them, re-ravel them, unweave them, reweave them. It's a type of magic based on a character I ran years and years ago who just used the tapestry as a direct metaphor. Her accomplice is known only as Sunder, and he is a mysterious necromancer that the Hollow Ones in Dallas picked up. No one really knows quite where he came from, but he is absolutely good at what he does. They don't want to let him go because no one else can do necromancy quite like him.
No one can necromancy quite like you. That's always a line I would like to have someone refer to me as.
We may or we may not unlock his tragic backstory someday, but there's a reason he's good at what he does.
Yeah. And this text is already out. It's $5 on Storyteller Vault. Again, Crushing Depth. Link will be in the show note, or just search TL Web or search Crushing Depth. It's the fifth story kind of in sequence. What would you say the inspirations for this are?
Initially, I was inspired by I think it was 2008, the speed rate live action speed racer that the Wachowskis made. The car combat was absolutely inspiring. I love a good demolition derby. Must be the Texan in me. But after that, I was like, wanted to build an adventure set in, around, and connected to Dallas. I grew up here. I've lived here all my life. There's a lot of crazy lore built in here. We've got the most haunted lake in North Texas at White Rock Lake, just north of downtown. There's a bunch of neat gothic stuff to build and play with around here. Not to mention the Kennedy assassination happened right downtown, and the whole world was focused on that. There are a bunch of authors that have inspired me and inspired the story. I mean, I spent a whole lot of time reading Robert Heinlein back in the early aughts. Somebody gave me Starship Troopers, and my habit is to just work my way author by author. I read a ridiculous amount of Stephen King and a ridiculous amount of Dean Koontz, and then I went through Robert Heinlein. And I love his science fiction. He's amazing at what he does. He's called the Grandmaster for a reason. There are some problems, what the kids would now call cancelable stuff that happened in his personal life and in his fiction. Is not all roses, but he was very dedicated to hard science fiction. He wanted it to make sense. When he and his wife were planning out a character's trip through the solar system, they unrolled a huge sheet of butcher paper and did the math by hand. And some kid asked him, well, why didn't you use a calculator? And he's like, this was 1957.
Yeah, he was born in 1907. So the fact that his female characters tend to be competent and strong, yet also kind of stereotypically female, okay. You get one.
He loves his characters spicy, male and female.
Yeah.
There's also, I can't not mention Chris Claremont, because the X-Men had a huge impact on me reading the things I read, the fiction I like. Chris Claremont wrote the X-Men for 17 years. He left the book right as I discovered the title, but I went back and read those old back issues at the comic shop in town, and I just fell in love with the way he had characters just bicker and play and tease each other through the course of everything. You have a character like the interdimensional alien Longshot sitting down for breakfast and gleefully saying, oh boy, dead burned animal flesh and unburned baby birds. This is going to be great. And he's not being gross, although they think he is. He's completely unironic about it. He's just, oh, this is what that is. And that alien perspective can be a lot of fun. Many of his characters brought that to the table. As he was an immigrant, he came over from Britain. That outsider perspective can be very important sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Kind of gave us the X-Men we certainly know and love, and dozens of other characters. Dark Phoenix Saga, Days of Future Past, probably the best-selling comic of all time, X-Men 1, the 1991 spinoff, or at least is in the Guinness Book for it.
It broke our hearts in Inferno.
We have an idea of what happens. We have an idea of who's doing it. Again, this is another installment for you. It is also nice to see that the reviews are generally between 4 and 5 star, and it doesn't have any 1 stars, because that to me is the sign. If there's a 1 star, if there's 1 or 2 1 star reviews, that is either the sign that somebody is shitting on you because you have like a gay character or something like that, and they're like, why are you bringing your politics into Mage? Or
I'm sure that'll happen sooner.
Yeah. Or it's actually bad and people are just starved for Mage fiction. So the fact that that isn't there is kind of the sign. It is entirely reasonable, readable. It's great for a phone. The pages are small. It's easy to go through. I have all of them.
We deliberately set it up so people could read it on their phone. That was kind of a goal. I wanted people, because I wrote this thing on my phone largely. I write wherever I go. I have a little Bluetooth keyboard. And if I have a few minutes, I'll pull that out and tap in a few words here and there. I don't have a lot of time to write lately. My wife broke her leg a couple months ago. She's having a real rough time of recovery. I got a 5-year-old. Life is crazy.
Any fun facts or details that you want to share before we just direct people to the Storyteller Vault?
Oh, yeah. This story had an interesting beginning. The week I started writing the story was the week that Kanye West started going crazy and talking about loving Hitler. And this is a story about me sending a black dude to the Hollow Earth to punch Nazis. And that just felt really odd as kind of a beginning. But at the same time, you know, this is a story that largely involves submersible travel. And the week I finished the first draft was when that Titanic sub imploded. And, you know, thankfully that is brief an end as you could ask for, but still terrifying and horrific. You're down there and just crunch.
That's certainly bookends. But if you want something where the characters probably don't all die, or if they do, they're at least fictional, grab Crushing Depths on the Storyteller Vault.
Looking forward to seeing what people make of this story. Like the feedback, there has been feedback. It's been not a lot of people who know there is fiction on the vault.
Yep. And we'll include a link to all those stories in the show notes. If you read it and you like it, leave a review. If you didn't like it, write your own. do something better. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes, please write more mage fiction. One of the biggest fires that can get in your belly to write is when you see someone else and you don't like how they did it. And you know what? If you don't like my story, that's fine. Do it better. Do one better. Top me. Go ahead. Go for it.
And when you do, tell me about it, and we can interview you about it on Mage the Podcast. Teal, have a lovely day.
I hope so. You too as well.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where we'd love to talk about what you've made. PM me or email us if you've made a mage thing that you'd like to share, and maybe we can turn it into an episode. No guarantees, though. There's a lot of real weird homebrews out there I've been approached by, and just that's a little out there for us. The show is brought to you by our executive producers, who you can join at patreon.com/matesthepodcast. First, we have the oracles of the following actual plays we wish existed. Ben Bendelow, Oracle of the Vampire Actual Play, Sucker for Punishment. Buck Gregory, Oracle of the Alternative Vampire Actual Play, Bite Club. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of the Werewolf Actual Play, Pause and Effect. Guy Stewart, Oracle of the Alternative Werewolf Actual Play, Moonlight Mishaps. Jay Widener, Oracle of the Mage Actual Play, Abra Debacle. Josh Hillerup, Oracle of the Alternative Mage Actual Play, Mystic Knife Fight. Mikhail, Oracle of the Changeling Actual Play, Glamour Shots. Pukaji, Oracle of the Alternative Changeling Actual Play, Fae School Musical. Sean Gallagher, Oracle of the Kindred of the East Actual Play, Yin Yang Yarns. The Crew of Erebus, Oracle of the Alternative Kindred of the East Actual Play, Tao of the Dead. St. UX Player, Oracle of the Wraith Actual Play, Spectral Shenanigans. Jason Vines, Oracle of the Mummy Actual Play, Rags to Riches. And Derek Semsick, Oracle of the Alternative Mummy Actual Play, Tomb It May Concern. You may wonder why I chose Kindred of the East and Mummy. Those are the ones I could come up with clever things for. Along with Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Michael Parker, Archmaster Morgan Aron, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Wolf Larryson, Alex, Alexia, Ambiversion, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blease Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Fregerock, George Lara, Gray Trillig H., Henry Kraft, Hugo the Bog Person, Ia Bull, Jason Duncan, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jen, Jervis Johnson, John Magnuson, Joel and Andes, Lulz and Stuff, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Wellesley Weatherstone, Manel Kanos, Matthew Prohl, Michael Maurice Hopkins, Michael Creedle, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klemenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Pax Cow, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bett Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Sploid, Sev Nessus, Starfish, Stefan Carton, Steve Winyard, Thrice Great, Tyler Bryan, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Our EP shout-out is to Gray Trillig H., who I assume the unit The Gray is named after. That's the unit for ionizing radiation in SI and represents a joule of energy per kilogram. That reduces to meter squared per second squared because units are weird sometimes. This is the equivalent to a sievert if you assume a quality factor of 1 or 100 rem or Rankine equivalent man units, although the conversion depends on relative biological effectiveness, RBE, and is more used when determining health effects. We largely use the RAD in the United States, which is the corresponding CGS unit, but it's strongly discouraged by the NIST, but Americans be like that sometimes. In a year, you'll get about 2 10,000ths of a gray from background radiation from just kind of the cosmos. A CT scan will give you about 15 1,000ths of a gray. A cancer treatment will give you between 20 and 80 gray spread over several weeks. For acute radiation sickness, a dose of about 1 to 2 gray will cause mild radiation sickness with symptoms like nausea and fatigue. A dose of 3 to 4 gray will cause severe radiation sickness, potentially fatal without medical treatment. And a dose of above 8 gray are usually fatal even with medical intervention. The Chernobyl nuclear disaster exposed some workers to doses in excess of 10 gray. Next time I think about acute radiation sickness, I'll think of you, Gray Trillig H. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super liked this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hobbin Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. Mage the Podcast is also on Mastodon at dice.camp at the name @magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on your platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.